and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this podcast, we'll be featuring Gary Borger, and he'll be answering your most important questions on long flies for big fish. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Gary a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and your email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Gary Borger about long flies for big fish. Our approach is simple, education. Fly Fusion is unique when it comes to fly fishing magazines. It is one of only a few magazines in North America that focuses on instruction and education. In Fly Fusion, we've covered subjects like short line nymphing, tactics for tough days, stillwater fly patterns, dry fly fishing for fussy trout, and a host of other interesting and educational topics. Visit our website today at www.flyfusionmag.com. That's www.flyfusionmag.com. And start your subscription to Fly Fusion today so that you can learn all you need to know about fly fishing. Before we introduce Gary, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For a drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Gary's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Gary's latest book, Long Flies. It's the third book in a 20-book series, which will explore a huge range of fly fishing topics over the next 5 years. And we'll have Gary tell us about more about that series later on in the show. Now, here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. And the question will be about something Gary and I talk about during the show. And you must submit your answer along with your name and your location in the text box on our homepage. So listen closely, use your best typing skills, and maybe you'll win Gary's latest book, Long Flies. But tonight our guest is Gary Borger. Gary has a PhD from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, is Professor Emeritus of Biology at the University of Wisconsin campus in Wausau, where he taught for 28 years. During his teaching career, he taught botany, zoology, natural history, photography, writing in the sciences, ecology, taxonomy, and other topics. He was presented with Teacher of the Year Award on two different occasions. Gary's one of the world's foremost fly fishing educators. He's been a fly fisher since 1955, and since 1972 has taught classes and lectured internationally on all aspects of fly fishing for trout and salmon. A freelance writer and photographer and an active member of the Outdoor Writers Association of America, Gary is also Midwest Field Editor for Fly Fishing Magazine, Editor-at-Large for the Virtual Fly Shop, and Fly Fishing Columnist for North American Fishermen. He has written 5 best-selling books on fly fishing, nymphing, naturals, the Borger color system, designing trout flies, and presentation, along with his current series, including long flies, which we're talking about tonight. Gary Borger pioneered fly fishing video instruction with his release of Nymphing in 1982, and since then has appeared in 4 videos for the 3M company, and in cooperation with the Federation of Fly Fishers, produced the environmental video, Where the Trout Are. His video production company has produced an additional 17 internationally acclaimed videos in the Skills of Fly Fishing series. In addition, he has appeared in TV productions on ESPN and OLN. Gary is also a consultant on Robert Redford's movie, A River Runs Through It. He is a founding member of the Board of Governors of the Federation of Fly Fishers Fly Casting Instruction Certification Program, a member of the Order of the Jungle Cock, Trout Unlimited, United Fly Tires, Federation of Fly Fishers, and many more that we don't have time to list tonight. Well, Gary, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. It's always good to have you on board.
Thanks, Roger. Great to be back.
Yeah, well, we got another book pumped out here. That's 3
Another
now,
one.
Right?
That's right.
Only 17 to go, is that it?
Only 7. That's not bad.
No? Well, you got a lot of work ahead of you.
Number 4 is written, and Jason's laying it out, and book number 5 is about half done. So we're
Wow. You guys are Well, that's the Borgers for you. Always got everything in line and organized and ready to go. So, you can tell us more about what's coming up next here in a little bit.
We will do that.
Good, good. This latest book of yours, which we're going to talk about tonight, I don't know that I've ever seen a book like this organized in this fashion around long flies. They always seem to be kind of a subset of some other book, but you've dedicated a whole book to it. So let's start out, first of all, about, you know, when you refer to long flies, what do you mean? You know, what is a long fly to you?
Well, by long flies, I mean imitations such as streamers, bucktails, leeches, and other flies that are typically tied to represent long organisms, and usually tied to represent very active organisms like minnows, sculpins, leeches, crayfish, you know, other kinds of sand eels, any kind of long food organism that fish normally would feed on are referred to as long flies.
Okay.
And if you just want sort of a baseline definition, any fly that could nominally be tied on a 3X long hook, we could call a long fly. Now, I say nominally because there are times when we tie long flies on short shank hooks. So if it's a fly that is natural would be longer than a 3X long, then I guess we would call that a long fly.
Right, right. Doug up in Calgary, Alberta, he asks, what he classifies as a long fly, which you just did. He says, does a long fly need to have certain characteristics? He says, do sun ray shadow or collie dog tube flies used for salmon and trout fit your description of a long fly? Are there particular techniques that are best for fishing long flies? And we'll talk about the techniques later on. But what about his sun ray shadow and collie dog tube flies?
Certainly they do. And certainly tube flies are long flies also. And you know, most of the salmon flies, steelhead flies, the big trout, bucktails and streamers, and things like woolly buggers and leeches, those are all long flies.
Mm-hmm.
And like I say, they represent food organisms that normally move about actively, and they're big organisms with a high calorie load. So big fish go after those because big fish need to eat large amounts of calories in order to survive.
And our next show, in fact, is going to be with Mike Redenisich on tying the classic salmon fly. So we're going to continue the conversation. I know you're probably familiar with his great work. Beautiful flies. So they become artwork as well, these long flies.
They certainly can be.
Yeah, yeah. You know, we talk about in the title of the show is, you know, long flies for big fish. Many of us think of that by fishing long flies, big flies, the bigger the fly, the bigger chance we have for catching a bigger fish. Is that, in fact, true, or are there two sides to that story, or what's your take on that?
Well, there might be two sides to it in the sense that you can catch big fish on small insect imitations. You know, trout, for example, big trout will feed on small insects, but they usually only do that when there's a huge abundance of small insects. And if there's not a huge abundance of small insects, they're going to be rooting around for other things. Big fish have a much higher calorie need than small fish. So big fish are going to look for bigger food items each time they go feeding than they are small ones, unless, like I say, there's just a huge abundance of small food items. Most trout that are over 25 inches are not caught on a size 26 midge. Most of them are caught on a big leech imitation or a great big streamer fly, usually at night. So these big fish that are prowling about looking for big food are more likely to take a big fly than a small fish. Although I've caught fish sometimes that were at the same length as the fly, basically. I mean, small fish will go after them too. But
well, that's,
when I'm
that's,
really
that's,
looking for a big fish, I want big flies.
Right, right. I've caught pike with like 34-inch pike with a 15-16-inch other pike hanging out of its mouth.
Yeah,
and they
pretty
still
amazing.
took my fly. You know, it's like, come on.
That's right. Well, you caught two for the price of one there.
Yeah. But those big fish always seem hungry. So as far as you know, we've got a lot of trout fishers, of course, on the show. We hear that a lot, you know. Get out there at night if you want the big fish, you know, sundown, and the big ones come up. But like you said, unless it's a really heavy hatch, you shouldn't expect on an average hatch to see the big fish at the surface. Is that the case?
Probably not the biggest ones, although, you know, there have been times when I've seen fish. Certainly in New Zealand, for example, if there's any hatch going on at all, you've got a chance of catching a fish 30 inches or longer. Mm-hmm. But that's just because they're so tuned into everything that's going on and watching for food, and there's a lot of big fish in New Zealand. Not a lot of fish, but a lot of big fish.
Is that because there's less food supplies than we'd find here in our river?
Yeah, there's a lot of pressure on fish there, not from humans, but the rivers flood pretty strongly during the spring runoff, because the country is very steep, and there's big eels in the rivers. There's lots of predatory birds that feed on fish. So the population's kept down, and because there aren't a lot of fish, the ones that are there get all the food, and they get to be pretty good size.
Mm-hmm. You've broken, in your book, you've broken down long flies into 10 different groups.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, can we kind of march through these groups and
sure.
Maybe you could tell us about the group, the characteristics of that group, and maybe some of your favorite flies in each group. And I know this, the trouble with this whole conversation is that a lot of these flies cover salt water and warm water and fresh water as well. So I know we're covering a lot of territory here tonight, but
and
asking a lot of you. But let's see what we can learn about each one of these groups, and starting out with the bucktails.
All right, bucktails and streamers are the two oldest of the long fly imitations that we have in the angling record. And although there are records of streamer flies. Streamers are those tied with some kind of a feather wing, whether it be an entire feather or whether it be feather components. We have records of those going back into the early 1800s in England, but they never became a really major part of the angling tackle until about the end of the mid to end of 1800s, when people in the United States really began utilizing these for trout, salmon, bass, pike, saltwater fish like stripers, blues, and other kind of fish like that. And bucktails and streamers seem to have arisen at roughly the same time, late 1800s, 1875 to 1890, sometime in that time period. Bucktails we could also call hairwing flies. Bucktails were originally tied with literally bucktail hair. In fact, the first fly that we know of that was tied with a bucktail hair was a fly tied in Fort Wayne, Indiana, by a fellow by the name of Hance, and he called it the Fort Wayne bucktail and used it to catch bass. So these are the two oldest types, bucktails and streamers, and typically when people talk about long flies, they call them streamers or they might call them a bucktail. But there's a lot of other categories that don't neatly fit into a hairwing fly or a streamer fly. Now, as far as bucktails goes, there's a lot of them around. When I first started tying flies in 1955, there were five of them listed in the Family Circle's Guide to Trout Flies, which is the book that I had in my fly tying kit that I got. And those included things like the black-nosed dace, the Mickey Finn, the squirrel tail, and other similar patterns that were, at that time, very popular and still remain popular. Black-nosed dace, for example, and the Mickey Finn are still widely used. But there's lots of other bucktails that people have come up with in the time period since then, and lots of hairwing flies. Hairwing flies are really good because light can go through the hair and sort of give them sort of translucency. And you have a lot of nice natural colors in hairs, like squirrel tail and other sorts of things, that make very nice-looking flies. Streamers really came into their own probably in the 1930s when Carrie Stevens began tying her very famous flies in the Wrangley region in Maine. And her flies, like the Gray Ghost, have remained popular ever since. They were tied with long feathers tied in at the head and then allowed to flow back along the sides of the hook more than on the top of the hook. try to imitate smelt and other kinds of minnow imitations that were, or other kinds of minnows that were in the lakes of that region. Then there's a group of flies we call strip flies, which were really sort of originated in New Zealand in about 1930, when the New Zealanders had to stop using matuka feathers to make their flies. So they were searching around for other kinds of things, and they came up with this idea of tying in a strip of rabbit hide with the fur left on. And that works very smoothly in the water and undulates beautifully. Well, the strip flies that we tie in this day and age are more tied matuka style, in that we tie it in at the head and then rib the strip onto the body so that it doesn't tangle as much around the hook. And there's any number of strip flies that are just really good. Now, I tie a couple in the strip leech series that I tie. I particularly happen to like because of the way they work in the water.
Now,
and, of course,
the bucktails and the streamers were they primarily designed for to imitate minnows more than anything else?
Yeah, they're more designed initially to imitate minnows than they were things like salamanders and so on. And leeches really sort of came into their own, probably. People have been tying flies that could have been leech imitations, but not specifying them as leech imitations. But probably in the mid-70s, people began to recognize this need to design imitations more specifically to imitate leeches. The woolly buggers, for example, came about in the late 60s, probably 67 to 69, somewhere in that region. And it's a superb leech imitation. It's just got a big marabou tail and then a body made of a variety of materials, often with a hackle wound over it, but it doesn't have to have that. And the idea in that one is that as the hook is pulled through the water and works up and down, the tail, of course, waves dramatically and looks like a swimming leech.
So the buggers and the strip flies were both designed to imitate leeches?
They can imitate minnows. You just have to tie them in the right color. And they make great minnow imitations. And the strip flies and the buggers, I mean, they've gone in every direction that you can imagine, from tarpon buggers to mudder-headed buggers, to fluorescent orange ones, the fish in Alaska, just about every color you can imagine and every shape you can imagine, but still using that concept of a tail that's made of marabou or other similar soft materials, and then a body in the front of it. And they do really, really well. I mean, buggers have achieved the status of a very high acclaim among all anglers that fish them. They're just superb flies.
I think that was one of the first flies I tied when I was a kid.
Because they fish really well. I mean, they fish really well.
Yeah. Now, do you think that the strip flies and the buggers, more than anything else, don't, as far as really trying to imitate a leech or anything, are more the activity, the movement of them that creates the strikes?
Yeah, that and a lot of times they're tied in, leechy kind of colors. One of the very, very popular buggers is, a woolly bugger is a black tail, an olive body, and a black hackle wound Palmer style over that. And that's very much a leech kind of color. Leeches tend to be browns and blacks and olivey browns and olivey blacks. And that's been one of the most popular colors in the buggers. Mm-hmm. But like I say, they're people tie them in every color. There's sculpin buggers, there's minnow buggers, there's everything you can imagine, with or without eyes, with or without beads on them, with or without fish skulls on them, just everything you can imagine.
Yeah, even the egg sucking leech in Alaska, right?
Oh yeah, which is a superb fly, let me tell you.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Whoever figured leeches ran around with eggs stuck in their mouth.
That's right.
But the fish seem to like them,
Fish like them, that's for sure.
Okay, so buggers was number four group, and so number five is muddlers and divers?
Muddlers and divers, yeah. Muddlers came about in 1936 when Don Gappin created his first muddler minnow, and he really tied it to imitate sculpins, the fish up in Canada for big brook trout. And the idea was that the head was bulky like a sculpin head. I don't know, because we don't really have any record, that Don ever thought about the fly creating an acoustic footprint. But I certainly do know that he designed that to imitate muddlers and that it worked extremely well. And it was not exactly like the way we tie them today. His had a squirrel tail wing with a mottled turkey on either side, and then a muddler head spun in the front, but it wasn't nearly as heavy and compacted as you see it in the flies of today. That really came about when Dan Bailey, who was a friend of Don Gappin, started tying them and selling them in Montana, and he sold them all over the world, and that's what really, really popularized the muddler minnow, was the effort that Dan Bailey put into the, you know, through his catalog selling those flies and so on. And he made the head much bulkier and much more compact. And they float quite nicely. So you have to fish them with shot, or you have to put some serious weight on there to get those things down. But once they do get down and you pull them through the water, they displace water very similar to the way a minnow would displace water. And like all other flies, as soon as, you know, fly tiers saw that concept, they just modified in every direction you can imagine. And perhaps the best modification ever done was to use marabou for the wing on the muddler minnow, because now you've got a marabou muddler, and it creates not only the acoustic footprint, but it also has that very strong visual impression of that wing swimming and moving and pulsing in the water. So it looks very much like a minnow, sounds like a minnow. Superb flies. And, of course, divers came about because Larry Dahlberg was looking for a fly to fish for muskies, literally, in the Red Cedar River in Wisconsin and other places in the upper Mississippi and so on. And Larry is one of these kind of guys that's not afraid to pick up a bait casting rod or a spinning rod or a fly rod. And so he understood the whole concept of this need to have a fly with a serious acoustic footprint so he could pull fish in to see what was going on. They'd hear that and they'd come to it. And his diver does that. So it floats. It's got a, looks like a triceratops collar at the back of the head. And when you pull it underwater, it makes a very loud gurgling and sound as it plunges down, and then it will rise back to the surface and you can do that again. You can do the same thing with muddlers because they float so well. You can pull them under. They don't create quite as much of a sound effect as the divers do, but they still work very good that way.
Right, right. Well, I want to come back to those two and talk about the acoustics of those in just a minute, but we
sure.
need to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Gary Borger talking about long flies. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 25 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging into their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Gary Borger about long flies for big fish. If you'd like to ask Gary a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Gary, at this point in the show, I always ask my guests what's going on in their fly fishing world, and I know you just got Long Flies published, so tell us how that's coming along, and are you shipping, and what can we expect next out of you?
Yeah, Long Flies is shipping. It just, in fact, I just got my first copies last week, and we had a pre-release sale on that, which is going on until April 22nd, if anybody's interested. The books are signed to the buyer and postage paid at $25, so they can go on my blog, which is just GaryBorger.com, and order copies if they want. The next book that's coming out is called The Angler is Predator, and in that I discuss not just the fact that anglers need to be predators, but a lot of the techniques that we use as predators, including casting techniques, including the need to understand the way the fish hear and the way the fish see, clothing items, how to stalk fish, hunting fish, various other topics. And it is being laid out right now and probably will be published a little bit later this spring.
Great.
Right after that comes Fly Gear, which discusses the ins and outs of all the tackle that we use, aimed more at the concepts of trying to help people understand better how to match rods to lines to not just say we want to have a balanced outfit, but we want an outfit that actually matches what it is that we're trying to do with that outfit. Mm-hmm. Are we going to fish spring creeks? Are we going to fish for tarpon? Are we going to fish for trout in eastern rivers? Are we going to go on big western rivers? Are we going to try to use spey rods? Are we going to try to use switch rods? Are we going to use scandy heads? Are we going to use, you know, skagits? Are we going to use weight fours? What are we going to do? So there has to be some underlying concept of all that, and that's what we'll be doing in fly gear.
Great.
Then after that will come three books on casting. And then after that, I don't remember.
Well, that'll keep you busy for the next
yeah.
year, I'm sure. Yeah,
I'll be busy.
Yeah, well, good. Well, thanks for sharing that. And again, your website is GaryBorger.com. So if you like to follow what Gary does and also order any of his books, you can go there and check that out. So that's terrific. Well, I wanted to – well, two things. I wanted to follow up on that question, you know, when you're talking about acoustics, because I don't know what the timing is on this, but I would assume that prior to these flies that acoustics was recognized in the bait casting world prior to the flies. Is that true, and was this new to the fly fishing when the muddlers and divers came into play?
Yeah, the bait guys and the spin cast guys, the plug guys, have recognized this concept of the acoustic footprint for a long time. In fact, you can buy lures that are specifically designed to create extra noise that have rattles in them and all sorts of things. And fly fishers have prowled around the edges of this for a long time. In fact, when you go back and look at some of the older fly fishing books from the 1930s, there's any number of long flies that were designed to use single spinner blades or airplane spinner blades on the front of them, not only to create flash, but to also create some kind of a disturbance in the water. And people have sort of understood this for a long time, but fly fishers, for some reason, have shied away from it, and I'm not really sure why. George Harvey clearly understood it when he designed his night fly that he would catch big browns on, and he was very, very good at catching those big browns. And his night fly had big wings sticking out to the side, scooped forward. They were actually feathers from the breast of a goose. And they looked very much like a crazy crawler plug. And that's probably where he got the idea, because George also loved to fish for bass with a plug rod, bass and pike and muskies with a plug rod. And he probably got that idea from the concept of the crazy crawler plug and others, and incorporated that into his fly, and it works very, very well. You can imagine any fish feeding at night, looking around for food, is not going to be able to see very far, but they can hear, and their lateral line mechanism allows to feel disturbances in the water that a swimming minnow or a crayfish or a leech would make, and then they can move in that direction, and then when they get close, if they see it, they'll feed on it. So using imitations that suggest not only the visual appearance of the food organism, but the sound of the food organism, can be very important in long flies. Of course, in fly fishing started by imitating flies, which were the adult insects. And adult insects don't make a lot of water even when they're stomping around. I mean, make a lot of sound even when they're stomping around on top of the water. So it was never necessary to really incorporate the acoustic footprint into insect imitations. So it was strictly all visual, and when people went to tying long flies, they just carried that visual concept over. In fact, if you look at streamers and bucktails, they're both thin flies. If you had a fly tying contest and you saw some of my flies that I tie as bucktails, they probably wouldn't win anything, because I don't stack the wing very precisely on top. I actually let it sort of roll around the hook to increase its bulk and make it more like a minnow to try to increase some of that acoustic footprint concept.
Yeah.
And there's lots of other things that people have added. And some people now are adding lips. Some people now are adding wings to them. Mark Petagine has come out with a wonderful thing he calls the Magic Head, which is like it looks like a little funnel inverted forward. So when you tie the fly, your fly looks like a pet that's just come home from the vet, you know, with one of those anti-lick collars on it.
Mm-hmm.
But when you pull that thing through the water, my goodness, does it swim. And
yeah.
creates a very strong acoustic footprint as well as a great visual footprint.
Yeah. You mentioned that prop fly, which I think was originated by Pete Parker, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, actually, those flies have been around for a long, long time.
Oh, has it?
In fact, Pete and I used to talk about it at the ISE shows. We used to talk about all these flies that from the old days that had spinner blades on them and the airplane propeller blades on them and so on and so on. Some of those actually were the Colorado spinner, which is not really just the body with no hook or anything on it, with a spinner blade. That was originally designed to be used on a fly.
Mm.
And they just would hang a fly on the Colorado spinner, and it worked great because it has it's got flash, plus it's got the acoustic footprint.
In fact, if people are interested in that, if they Google Pete's prop fly, you'll see tying instructions for that. I just was Googling while you were talking because I remembered talking about that. But I know there's some controversy about those kinds of flies because it says, well, is this a fly or is this a plug, you know?
Right.
And I know a lot of purists would say, no, you know, it's not really a fly. But I don't know where that begins and where that, you know, argument ends.
Well, according to the Missouri Department of Natural Resources, if it has hair or fur or feathers tied on it, it's a fly. So you can legally fish a rooster tail spinner in fly-only water.
Really? So that's legal status, huh?
That's the legal status of it, yeah. Where it goes from there, anybody's guess.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. I never thought about that aspect because fly-only water, right? You know, you got to think about that stuff. Yeah. Okay, well, that's, I think our next category, number six, is collared flies.
Mm-hmm. And collared flies are those in which we spin a collar to create the fly itself. And typically this is done in a spinning loop. So you make a spinning loop out of thread. You insert material into the thread, typically at right angles to the thread, like long fur or marabou or other materials. You spin that very tightly to form a giant chenille, and then you wind that on the hook, and that makes the body and also forms a nice compacted head inside, so you're basically getting that muddler effect, but it's inside the body instead of on the outside. And so the fly does push a lot of water. And I tie a lot of the collared flies. I think they're wonderful. Mm-hmm. Easy to tie and fish extremely well.
Are those, do we see a lot of saltwater flies that are collared flies?
Lefty's Deceiver is a sort of a form of collared fly. It wasn't tied by spinning material on the front, but it is tied by placing clumps of material around the top, basically the top half, the top three quarters of the hook. So it is a semi collared fly, but the design was such that it would push a lot of water,
mm-hmm.
and that's what collared flies tend to do. And they also, if they're tied with things like extra fine craft fur, or if they're tied with Arctic fox tail or Arctic fox hair or other long hairs like that, yak hair and other kinds of things, can be very, very mobile in the water. I mean, you just have a tremendous visual footprint. I tie a fly that has a tail of this very fine craft fur, and then I make dubbing out of it and put that on the body and then put a big collar on the front, and I call it a collared leech. And to me, it's one of the best big fish flies I've ever developed or used, simply because it has tremendous action in the water, and then like a muddler or diver swan, pushes a lot of water, but it sinks beautifully too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Are there other names, common names of collared flies that people would recognize?
Flies like the popsicle, which is a fly that's used in Alaska that George Cook developed. That's a collared fly. The Intruder series are all collared flies. Some of the tube flies are collared flies. So there's a wide variety of imitations that are developed that way, but they're all imitations that are designed as long fly imitations.
So I noticed in your book, the Down and Dirty Minnow series.
Yeah,
the
Down and Dirty series, yeah.
Yeah.
Those are basically just nothing but that material wound on. No body, no tail, no nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And they make really
good what?
Easy to tie. That's why I like them so much.
Yeah.
I don't sweat it if I lose a couple, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, and we got a couple questions in on the internet here, so let me grab a couple of those here real
sure.
quick. One was, I'm kind of backtracking here a little bit, Dennis and Helena Montana wanted to know, do you prefer to wake the fly or the leader when you're trying to get these down deep?
Well, there's some of both actually going on. Depends on what I want out of the fly itself. If I'm tying the fly specifically to be fished on the bottom, then I probably want to tie it with something like a sculpin helmet, or with heavy eyes, or maybe a jig style with a swimming jig bent hook, you know, where the front is bent up at about a 45-degree angle, so the thing will roll over and ride with the hook point up. And then that's a fly that I want to specifically jig, and I want to typically fish it on the swinging jig or some technique or some other thing where it bounces across the bottom. A lot of times I dress flies that I might want to fish in shallow water and or deep water. I might want to fish it fast. I might want to fish it slow. I might want to fish it over a weed bed or not over a weed bed. So a lot of times I don't put any weight on the fly at all and then add weight to the leader or use a sinking or sink tip line to get them down.
Okay. Another question from the internet, Jim in Jefferson City, Missouri. You want to know if you know where the term streamer originally came from. Did it have anything to do with long, thin flags that are called streamers, or do you know?
Yeah, most likely it did, because streamer flies are long and could, you know, look like a streamer made from as a flag or something like that. The things that I've read about it seem to suggest that that's where the name came from, that because of their shape, they look like streamers, cloth streamers, and so they were given that name.
Okay. Okay, so that's codified. Number seven is the grouping is tube flies.
Yeah, tube flies are probably most used by Atlantic salmon fishers and by people that fish for steelhead with spey rods. Tube flies are much easier to cast with a spey rod than a fly of equal length with a wire hook. The reason being that you only have a very lightweight tube, or you could have heavy tubes if you wanted, but many of the tube flies are designed for salmon flies to swing right underneath the surface. So they typically are made on plastic tubes. And you can make a nice long fly, and then what you do is you run your leader through the tube out the other end and tie your hook on, so you can use a hook of any size, of any style that you want. Tube flies originated in England, and the idea was that you could use a treble hook with it because you couldn't get long shank treble hooks. The idea being, of course, that if you hook a fish with a treble hook, it's a much more secure hookup than if you use a double or a single hook, which is not really true, but that was the idea at the time. Most people that fish tube flies now just fish a single point hook on them. And sometimes they'll put a thin tube of latex at the back of the plastic tube so they can pull the hook into that and keep it in place. Other people don't worry about it. They just sort of jam the hook into the end of the plastic tube, or they'll just tie a knot so that the tube doesn't slide down too far onto the hook. And there's a number of different ways in which they're rigged. Some of them are even rigged to fish in what we call a riffling hitch. A riffle hitch was originally designed in salmon fishing, where they would put a half hitch on the leader and put that over the head of the fly behind the head. So when you cast down and across, instead of the fly being pulled by its nose, it'd be pulled a little bit by its side, and it would slide sideways in the water. That tends to create more of a movement in the water and more of a motion in the water and more pushing of water than a fly that's simply hung by its nose. So what they'll do in tube flies is they'll burn a hole in the side of the tube fly and then run the line in the side and out the back and put their hook on.
Hmm.
There's all sorts of different variations. But
weren't
they certainly
also,
do cast. Go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say, weren't they used for, a lot of people use them for the stinger effect, for short strikes or trying to.
Yeah, you can use them for the stinger effect kind of thing. And another whole area that's opening up here that people haven't really thought about too much and used too much is using the idea of a tube fly with another long fly to produce an articulated fly. So instead of tying one hook and cutting it off and then tying another hook and having it hang out the back of the first one and creating a lot of weight, what you do is you use a tube fly in the front and then a long fly on the back, and then you can have an articulated fly, which will swim much better. And then if you can mix and match colors that way. You can have, you know, some that are silver and gold and black and brown and white and all of them. Then you can just mix them up however you want. And that's starting to find a little more acceptance, especially in places where articulated flies, especially for things like pike and other big fish where you need fairly long flies, but you don't want a tremendous amount of weight to have to cast.
Right, right. I know we did an interview with Kelly Gallup, and
yeah.
He did an interview on fishing streamers up there in Montana.
Sure.
He's a big proponent of the articulated fly, and you know, for trout, for big trout.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and he's got a
especially
lot of
especially for big trout.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's what he's after, I think.
Exactly right.
But is the general idea of an articulated fly fall in another area? Is it under our other category?
Well, actually, you know, articulated flies could be tied with bucktails. It could be tied with streamers. It could be tied with strip flies or buggers. And I mean, they're all these could be. All these classes could be made into articulated flies.
Okay.
All we mean by an articulated fly is one that's jointed. So they could be jointed two places or three places or one, you know, jointed in the middle in one place.
Yeah.
Sometimes you could use a short fly and a long fly together.
Mm-hmm.
So you could have a regular size 10 in the front, and then behind that you could have a 4X long or 3X long fly behind it. But use the short one in the front, like the head part, so the head part's wiggling up and down and the back part's wiggling different. Basically, it's like tying a bugger fly, but making it out of different material than a bugger, but getting that same kind of an effect because the articulation will allow it to work and swim much better.
Again, going back to plug designs, right?
Absolutely.
Two-jointed or three-jointed plug. Huh?
That's right, boy, and they really work. My goodness,
yeah.
They work.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, anything else on tube flies you want to share?
Well, tube flies are basically restricted to larger flies because there's no way to get tubes small enough to tie a 28 midge, you know.
Right.
So most of the tube flies that you find fall into this long fly category, although there are some that are tied as large wet flies and some that might be tied to imitate big nymphs or grasshoppers or something like that. But most of the time, tube flies find their greatest use and probably their best use as long flies of some sort.
Okay. Let's take another quick break here, and then when we'll
sure.
come back, we'll talk next about number 8, which is film flies. So stick with me, folks. We'll be right back, and we'll be talking about film flies. Women's fly fishing in Alaska is owned and operated by well-known female guide Pudge Kleinkopf. Women's fly fishing offers several large lodge-based fly fishing schools for women, as well as an array of small group-guided trips for women and couples to some of Alaska's best-known waters for salmon, rainbow trout, Arctic grayling, and char. But also, Pudge also leads saltwater fly fishing groups to Mexico each spring. Beginners are welcome, and equipment is provided. Learn more about fly fishing for women at www.womensflyfishing.net. That's www.womensflyfishing.net. Or call Pudge directly at 907-274-7113. That's 907-274-7113. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Gary Borger about long flies for big fish. If you'd like to ask Gary a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of those questions as possible on the show tonight. Okay, let me just do that right now, see what kind of questions we got coming in. Here's one. Trag up in Moscow, Idaho, wants to know, do you ever use more than one tube fly, in other words, two tubes against each other?
Absolutely. Makes a great articulation, as we mentioned a little bit ago. You can use two tubes, or you can use a tube in the front and a long fly behind that, or any number of things, any number of combinations, because it makes a great articulated fly like that. It really does.
Okay. We'll talk. I've got a couple other questions that are talking about flies themselves, which we'll talk about when we talk about fly tying here in a minute. So let's go back to our agenda here, and tell us about film flies.
Film flies are those which are specifically designed to be fished as topwater lures. So you've got things like, you could consider the diver and even the muddler. I mean, the muddler floats really great. And the diver is a great film fly, which is designed to be fished and make sound in the film. Of course, you pull it under the surface, but then you let it rise back again. So it's really designed to cause disturbance in the film and pull fish up to take it at the film. But then you've got things like poppers and bass bugs and any number of other imitations which are designed very specifically for that. Lee Haskin has created a whole series of really tremendous film flies that use very dense foam to hold them on the surface and also to give them action and to make them extremely tough. And Lee developed some really wonderful acoustic flies, one of which he calls the Sub-Zero, which when you pull it creates about 100 decibels of sound. It'll pull fish in from 100 feet away. Just a great fly, and I show that in the Long Flies book. But his idea was that, again, you've got the acoustic footprint, you've got a tremendous amount of activity at the surface, you get this big slash on the surface, and you get a big gurgling sound. Creates a really strong and very positive attraction for fish. And Lee fishes it down on the Sacramento Delta for regular bass, but also for stripers, and it works very well there.
Now, so that would include things like mice?
Oh, yeah. Very definitely mice. Anybody that's ever fished Alaska and had a 10-pound rainbow leap out and take a mouse on the way down really gets turned on to film flies, let me tell you.
Yeah, that could be exciting, yeah.
Yeah.
And then next up is techno flies. What is a techno fly?
Well, techno flies are the ones that some people go like, you'd never catch me fishing one of those things. So here we're talking about flies with lips and crawler wings on them and spinner blades on the front and a number of these other areas where people are experimenting, trying to figure out ways to create imitations to really best imitate some things that classically flies may not have imitated or imitations that are much more strongly attractive to the fish than you would normally think. Pencil poppers could be sort of considered a techno fly in the sense that they're not really designed as much as a popper as they are more of almost a floating minnow imitation. Charlie Brooks used to design floating minnow imitations tied with the quill from a goose feather or a big turkey feather or something like that, try to make them float on top and create a lot of surface disturbance. There are some tropical species like Sardinata, for example, that respond basically to sound. You throw a fly at them and it doesn't make any sound, they won't even look at it. Hmm. You throw something like a Czar Spook out there, a big plug that makes all kinds of noise and rattle, they'll just come and pound that thing, pound it and pound it. So you need something that creates not only sound but has a lot of motion in it. And that's where things like spinner blades or lips or various other kinds of things. Bill Shearer up here in Wisconsin fishes for muskies all the time. He's got several big, basically they're just giant lures but tied as flies with big lips on them and so on, because if you don't have a lot of bulk and that thing doesn't move, muskies aren't going to look at it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, you know, one of the very best muskie lures is a big old bucktail spinner. So it's got lots of flash and motion and that sort of thing. And we need to be able to do that, but we need to be able to, at the same time, to be able to cast these things efficiently and effectively on a fly rod. Mm-hmm. And so while somebody might not accept a metal spinner blade on their fly, they may accept a plastic one on there because it's a lot easier to cast, creates the same kind of sound and flash in the water that a metal one would. So people are exploring in all those directions right now. And I think right now, looking at the fly tying community, that there's probably more exploration in the long fly area than in any other area of fly tying at the moment, simply because we are going so many different places with our fly rods now and searching for a lot of other species besides just trout and salmon.
Well, I know our first question under our fly tying category for tonight here involves synthetics, so we'll talk about that in a minute, and I think that might relate to this trend. But sure. Our last category is other. So
yeah, other.
What is other?
Things that don't neatly fall into the first nine. So basically, under other, I put flies that are not really necessarily big swimming flies, but which are long. Things like stonefly nymphs. Things like helger mites. So basically the invertebrates that are long and wouldn't neatly fit into a long fly category of a streamer, a bucktail, or something like that. These really don't have wings on them. They really don't have big bugger tails on them. They really don't have muddler heads on them. They really aren't designed to float. You know, but they are long because you could easily tie these and often do tie them on 3X and longer hooks. Mm-hmm. And so I mentioned some of these in there also just to get people thinking in that direction and understanding that the whole concept of long fly typically means something big, and you can certainly take big fish on stonefly nymphs.
Sure. Yeah,
and we get really big browns running in here in the fall in Wisconsin, running into our streams, and we've taken 18 to 20 pound browns on those stonefly nymphs.
Wow.
So you can get big ones on them. Definitely.
Well, moving on to talking about fly tying, these longer flies, Frank Wood in California want to know, do you tie long flies with synthetic materials? And I right away, when I saw that question, thought, oh, a lot of saltwater flies are tied with synthetics nowadays. And is that one of the reasons that you're seeing more work with longer flies is because of synthetics?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah. I mean, some of these materials are just wonderful. I mean, you can get them in the lengths up to 11 and 12 inches. If you're going to tie a sandy limitation, which is anywhere from 6 to 12 inches long, you're going to need some kind of material that's going to hold together. It's not going to suck up a lot of water. It's going to make it easy to cast, you know, and have hair-like qualities. And so you see things that are kinked monofilament, polyester materials, a variety of other materials that are used to make these elongate fibers, some of which are fairly thin and others of which are a little bit heavier. They all have a wonderful action and motion in the water and produce wonderful long flies. Then there are long synthetic hairs, too, like this extra fine craft fur that I mentioned. It's really not craft fur. It's really fur that was designed for the fashion industry, and the fibers in that can be up to 3 to 3.5 inches, depending upon where you get it and what kind of, you know, who produced it and so on. But these make wonderful materials for collared flies, for bucktails. I cut it up and make it into dubbing and tie buggers. I don't even need to put hackle on it. Just cut it into chunks about 3/4 of an inch long and make dubbing and spin that into a loop and spin it on and make a body that produces, almost looks like a hackle wound on the outside of it. And one of the reasons I like synthetics so much is, number one, they're easier to get at times when it's difficult. For example, buying deer hides, all the Chinese were buying up deer like crazy and bucktails, and it was hard to get those things. But you can get synthetics because they're produced often for other industries and are around all the time. In addition, they tend to hold dyes better, and they tend to be more uniform in coloration when you do dye them. So one time you dye them, they're olive green. The next time you dye them, they're olive green. Natural material, one time you dye it, it's olive yellow, and the next time it's olive green, and the next time it's olive brown. And it's
right.
Much more difficult to control in natural materials than it is in synthetic materials.
Right.
So, yeah, you see lots and lots of synthetics being used now. And that's good because a lot of times they're lighter than hair. They don't suck up water. Hair itself will actually absorb water and swell. A lot of these materials like polyesters, they don't absorb water at all. period. So they'll remain the same size, same shape. You make one cast and all the water comes out, so it's real easy to throw the fly and so on.
Right, right. Jim in White Plains, New York, wrote in, and he says, I fish mostly on the Croton Watershed, New York City, mm-hmm. reservoir tailwaters for trout. And he says, what length, 3X, 4X, et cetera, hooks do you use, and what gap ratios do you prefer for single hook flies? And also, do you prefer single or tandem flies?
Well, I don't like to use hooks much longer than 6X, and I rarely use them that long. Most of the time I'm using 3X or 4X long. The reason I don't like them longer than that is, even though I know there are times when people have tied them up to, I mean, Carrie Stevens tied her Grey Ghost on 10X longs, but when you get a hook that's that long, it acts like a lever arm that works that point back and forth and tears it out of the fish's mouth. So if I'm going to hooks that are longer or imitations that are longer than I can really dress comfortably on them, let's say 6X is the maximum I'd ever use. If I'm going to do that, though, typically I would articulate them, or like I said, I'd tie a tube and then another one and articulate them that way, mm-hmm. so that I've got a long fly, but I've got that concept of the motion increased in it, and shorter hooks that are much less likely to tear out of the fish's mouth.
And I think that, is there particular gaps that are specified, or do they all have the same gap?
Well, here's the way it works. A standard hook in fly tying, and this took a long time for manufacturers to finally come to this point, but now they all use the standard measure. A standard hook has a shank that is 1.5 times the length of the gap. Anything longer than that is considered a long fly or a long hook. Now, the way they set this up is that if the hook has a shank the same length as a hook one size larger, it would be a 1X long shank. So if a size 12 hook had the same shank length as a size 11, it would be a 1X long hook. If a size 12 hook had the same shank length as a size 10, it would be a 2X long hook. That's the way that X's are designated. Mm-hmm. So typically, when you'd say a 3X long, you'd mean a size 12 hook with a shank length of a size 9 standard hook. So the gap ratio is indicated basically by the X number. So if I say it's a 4X long, I mean it's a size 12 with a size 8 standard length shank on it. That's the way they did it.
When you said the hooks you liked using were either 3 or 4X, were you mm-hmm. 3 or 4X longs or just 3?
Yes, 3 or 4X longs, yes.
Longs, okay. Just wanted to be mm-hmm. clear on that. Okay, you just answered Rick Takahashi's question from Fort Collins. Rick's been on our show talking about midges. And
no long flies for midges, sorry, Rick.
Yeah, but he wanted to know about that leverage of the hook.
So, yes, absolutely.
And you just answered that, so
yep.
That is a factor of going.
It definitely is a factor.
Yeah. Thomas Murphy in Redmond, Washington, wrote in, and he says, when I think of long flies, I think of bait fish imitations like flat wings, Miyawaki poppers, chum fry. When I'm tying long flies, are there proportions I should keep in mind?
Well, yeah. I think long flies, we should try to proportion like the real organism that we're trying to imitate. And when you think about it, we're not just talking about proportion top to bottom and front to back. We're talking about also the width of it. So minnows, in addition to being having a top to bottom width and a length, also have a side to side width. That's one of the reasons that I like these collared flies so much, is because when you spin that material on there, you get a fly that's thick in both directions, side to side as well as top to bottom, and it pushes water like a regular minnow does. That's why the mother minnow works so good, because it pushes water. So when we think about designing flies in terms of proportions, we ought to not only be thinking about proportions in terms of, like I say, height and length, But we also need to think about width and the way in which those things move when they're in the water. A minnow swimming through the water displaces water, not only because of its body volume, but also because it is pushing from side to side against the water. And any fly that creates a similar kind of movement in the water is going to be more effective than one which does not.
Okay. Ed in Massachusetts asked, do you have any specific tips for tying a non-fouling double bunny fly about 8 inches long? And what do you have any other general tips when tying long flies?
Man, that baby's going to be fun to throw. A bunny fly 8 inches long, weigh about 3 pounds. Actually, what I do is I take the fake craft fur, and this stuff is very interesting because it's designed for the fashion industry. They put it on a tricot fabric, so it will stretch in the cross grain direction, but not in the long grain direction. So the long grain would be the way the hair naturally lays. If you cut it across there, you can actually stretch it out and make very wonderful tails out of it to tie into these giant long flies. I use it for muskies and pike and that kind of stuff. And if you need to stitch a hook into it, what you do is I use 30-pound gel-spun polyester. And I tie a hook on there. Then I thread that into a needle. And then I stitch the needle from back to front through that. Just stitch it right through so that the hook is at the back. And then this material runs all the way through the strip, all the way to the front. And then, of course, you tie that in and on the hook. And then you have the hook actually stitched right in the material, so the material will wave and work around, and the hook won't be displaced at all. It'll hang right at the back and never move right where you want it to be.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's a really slick technique. Works really well.
So that the body is actually totally flexible. I mean,
yep.
And the line is going through that, so you have that as the strength there. Yeah.
You just stitch it lengthwise. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't just poke it in the back and put it up to the front. You stitch it right through so that it's woven right through there, and then that way it doesn't move around and it doesn't get caught in anything and material. You know, sometimes if you just have it hanging down, pieces of weed and things will get between that and the body, and I mean the wing and whatever. So I just stitch it in there. It works really great.
Another question from Bob in Flushing, Michigan, want to know. He says a lot of people are tying and flinging tandem flies. Aside from hiding the stinger hook in the front hook's dressing, is there any reason the stinger and its dressing should ride down instead of up or at any random angle for that matter?
Doesn't really matter. Some people prefer the stinger to ride up. Some people prefer it to ride down. The reason some people like it to ride up is because then you've got one hook pointing up, the back one, and then you got the front one pointing down. So I guess if they take the whole thing, you catch them top and bottom.
Mm-hmm.
But some people tie them all riding down. Some people tie them, like I said, split. Some people tie them the front fly so that it rides with the hook point up, and then, of course, you would want the stinger also to ride up.
Right, right. Need to take a quick break here, but we'll be right back and talk about equipment real briefly and some presentation techniques. So hang with me, folks. Have you ever dreamed about the classic actions of bamboo fly rods? Did you know that it's possible to make your own bamboo fly rods? With the help of Power Fibers Online Magazine, you can do just that. Power Fibers is a magazine dedicated to making bamboo fly rods, telling the stories about bamboo through the ages. From rod making techniques to stories about fishing bamboo rods to rod maker profiles, Classic Tapers Power Fibers has it all. Visit their website at www.powerfibers.com. That's www.powerfibers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Gary Borger about long flies for big fish. If you'd like to ask Gary a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. We had a question, Gary, about from Tom Koch in Roswell, Georgia, about what weight rods would be preferred, and what about floating and sinking lines? I know you're going to write a whole book about equipment, but when we're talking about long flies, we're talking about a lot of weight, and can you talk in general? I know we got saltwater, freshwater, all that stuff, but in general, sure. Are there certain principles that should be followed here to make it easier to cast and more effective?
I think it's actually the casting technique more than it is the line. or line weight. I will say, before we get into the casting technique, that if I know that I'm going to be fishing long flies, not, in other words, I'm not just out trout fishing and whatever happens that day happens, and I have my dry flies and my nymphs and, you know, some long flies. And but if I know specifically I'm going, I typically take a 7 weight or heavier, because throwing long flies all day long can be arduous. Not only that, but you sometimes hang into some pretty good-sized fish, and a 7 weight will give you just a little bit more, you know, butt pressure and that kind of stuff you can put on a fish when you're fighting it. Now, beyond that, of course, if you're going for tarpon, you don't want a 7, you want a 12. And if you're going for big salmon, you might want a 10, and so on and so on. But
right.
A 7 is sort of the lower end that I'd go to if I was just aiming specifically at fishing long flies and only long flies.
Okay.
Now, beyond that, let me say this. Casting technique is everything when it comes to throwing long flies, sink tip lines, split shot, you know, flies with a lot of weight on them, and so on. And you want to use an elliptical stroke when you do this. An elliptical stroke completely eliminates the worry of the old chuck and duck casting with a, you know, where you had to have a crash helmet on and you had to wear flak jackets and all that kind of stuff. What you do is you take the, on the backstroke, you make it slightly sidearm so that the rod goes back in a slightly sidearm plane. Then you bring the rod on around so that on the forward stroke, you make it with the rod more upright. So in other words, the rod plane going back is different than the rod plane coming forward. Therefore, the line plane on the backstroke is also different than the line plane on the forward stroke. When you do this, the fly is not going to hit you. You're basically just swinging it through the air. If you think of, if I gave you a brick on a piece of rope and told you to throw the brick by holding onto the rope, you wouldn't try to cast it back and forth like you would cast a false cast with a dry fly. You'd want to swing it around through the air so you didn't bang yourself and let her go. Well, that's basically what you do. You throw the fly back in one area, swing it around, and then cast it in a different at a different angle. And if you do that, you can throw long flies all day long and never hit yourself.
Mm-hmm. That's a good thing, not hitting yourself.
Yes, it is, especially with long flies. They really dig in, let me tell you.
Thomas Murphy in Washington again says that when he thinks of long flies, he thinks of a big wind-resistant fly. And he says, must I master the double haul to really effectively throw these flies? And how do I get down the timing? I guess
okay.
Another timing of the double haul. So.
Yeah, let's just talk about double hauling in general, because the double haul helps with everything. It really helps with long flies because, number one, if a long fly's got weight on it, it's going to travel slower through the air than will, say, a dry fly, because it's a heavier, it's more mass, you know, it's like split shot. As a consequence, if you can put more energy into the line, you can make it fly a little faster. It means it stings more if it hits you, but on the other hand, if it flies faster through the air, less chance that it's going to sink and hit the ground or get caught in bushes or whatever, and the more accurately you can throw it. So hauling helps dramatically in casting any kind of long fly or poppers or big air-resistant or wind-resistant flies. I double haul all the time for everything,
mm-hmm.
no matter what I'm fishing. Just because once you learn how to haul, it makes all of your casting easier, and you don't want to give it up for anything.
Right.
Now,
yeah, that's the way I felt.
Yeah,
I learned.
Absolutely.
Like, where was this? Where have I been? You know?
Yeah, where have I been all my life?
Right? Yeah.
I should have been double hauling.
Doing that for dry flies, you know, just to get
the lake,
you know. So,
absolutely. And if there's even the slightest bit of wind, which is most of the time, that helps, really helps when you're casting into the wind.
Okay,
now,
George, go ahead.
I was going to say something about the timing because he wants to work on that.
That's right.
The haul with the line hand is made right when the loop is formed with the casting hand. So that's right at the very end of the stroke. At the very end of the stroke, the rod tip is flipped over and the rod is stopped abruptly. So right when that rod tip is being flipped over, just before it stops, that's when the haul wants to come.
Mm-hmm.
When the rod tip is being flipped over is when the most energy is being applied to the rod, to the line. That's when you also want to haul it. So the haul adds energy to the line along with the rod tip when it's being flipped, and you can actually double line speed by doing that. A really good technique for learning how to haul at the correct time is to say the words haul late. And then you haul when you say the word late. So you're casting, you go haul, that's the rod is moving. And then you say late, by that time you're just flipping the rod tip over. So if you say haul late on the backstroke and haul late on the forward stroke, the timing will be correct. And you will get a really nice cast. The loop will tighten. It'll go extremely fast. Be able to do all the things you always wanted to do, including throwing long flies into the next time zone.
There you
right?
Go.
Right.
Okay, George in Alabama, he says he fishes with 12-inch pike flies to 3-inch bass flies. And he basically wants to know, does leader make length really matter when you're dealing with flies that big and fish that are aggressive enough to take those flies?
That really depends on as much the water quality and water clarity as it does anything. Yes, big fish, if they're after that big fly, are going to come and take it, whether that fly line's hanging there or not. But I know some places where the water's very clear, and big fish want a little bit of space between that fly and the line. But certainly 7.5-foot leader is more than enough. Now, if you're going to fish saltwater and you're going out on the flats and you're going to fish a long fly for bonefish, hey, you might need a 10 or 12-foot leader. And that might have to taper down to 6 pounds because they can get quite spooky.
Right.
I know guys that prefer to fish stillwater situations and saltwater situations with clear lines. They use floating lines, but they're clear because they think that the fish has less chance of seeing the line, and they swear by them. I'm not so sure that sometimes people might swear at them as much as they swear at them because they can't see them very well, but they certainly do work.
Okay. We have, I'm going to kind of hold that question on salt here for a minute. Steve Perry in Monument, Colorado, I think it's Colorado, asked, do you have any advices or techniques on fishing streamers doing active hatch? And I'm assuming he's trying to do, you know, something other than matching the hatch, which a lot of people think is effective. Well, how do you feel about that?
Well, there's certainly nothing wrong with fishing long flies. I mean, look, if we look at the other category, if there's stone flies around, you can certainly be fishing nymphs when there's adults around. Although the adults don't hatch on the surface of the water, you know, they're just coming back to lay eggs. But a lot of times I'll fish nymphs when they're taking adults off the top, and they take the nymphs quite nicely. Also, got to consider fishing a leech imitation, something like a bugger or a strip fly or something like that, or a big collared fly or something, like they would fish nymphs. That is, with a strike indicator and a split shot and just bounce them down on the bottom. A lot of times big fish during a hatch, big fish will stay deep, simply because they're just a little bit goosey about coming up to the top and exposing themselves. So fishing a big fly down on the bottom sometimes will be very attractive to those big fish. And other times you might see a fish rise, a big strong rise. That may be a big fish coming up eating a small fish that's eating insects. If that's the case, then putting on a long fly and fishing it there may be more successful for that big fish than simply putting on a dry fly and trying for him.
Right. Question all the way from the UK here, Steve Goodchild. He says, my local river is fast, shallow water, then small pockets of deep water, then larger pools, Fish in the river include salmon, sea trout, brown trout. In the UK and especially northern rivers, we don't seem to use so many lure-type flies like woolly boogers on the river. We also use traditionally small to medium flies, 14 to 12 wets. Unless we're targeting salmon, which we use larger flies. Can you please share any insider tips for a new time user with what to start? So I guess he's looking, he's ready to move up into long flies here, which isn't traditional in the UK, and wanting to know where to start with that.
And typically I might mention that long flies in the UK are called lures. Not meaning that they're made out of metal or anything, but that was to separate them from flies, which imitated insects, and originally flies imitated only adult insects. And then, of course, you have nymphs, which are separate from flies and so on. So lures were imitations of minnows and other kinds of things. And lures in England have found great acceptance, especially on still water systems. There's some very interesting, quote-unquote, lures, long flies that they tie, fluorescent orange and fluorescent pink and a number of other kinds of things. And, of course, there are tube flies which are used for salmon. But I would recommend starting out with flies like, probably with things like buggers and so on, because and muddlers, because they are so attractive to fish. And they're relatively easy to fish. Basically, you can fish them any style you want. Cast them and just let them bounce. Cast them and strip them. Cast them, swing them. Cast them, let them float dead drift sideways. They really work great in places where there's pocket water, where there's, you know, shallow water with deep pockets, because you can bounce one down with a something like a sculpin helmet or with bead eyes on it. You can bounce them down and drop them into those pool, into those deeper waters where the bigger fish are holding, and they just work great that way.
Hey, we got Daniel Gonslaves in Lake Havasu City, Arizona. All right, and this is kind of a long one, but I think there might be a couple things in here that you can address. He says he lives about 60 miles from a spot by a trout hatchery where every Friday they plant 13-inch rainbows. He says, plus there's a large concentration of 40-pound stripers. I've seen them swirl taking these trout on the surface. But
oh, yeah.
Getting them to take a fly that size almost always leaves me short-striped. He misses the fish.
Yep.
The flies he ties are made of pearl, Christmas tinsel, and crystal flash, but with only one hook in the head. He's wondering if she should tie a tandem rig. He's also using a heavy 12-weight to be able to set the hook. He says, Gary, sure. You've been fishing for a long time. I've had magazines that date back to the early 1970s. Probably further back than that. That's the only ones he has, right?
Yeah.
With the articles you wrote, so he'd respect your advice on trying to get hooked up with these stripers.
Yeah, I think definitely I would go with some kind of a stinger hook, probably on a fairly stiff, like about 40-pound mono or something, so that it would hold out, especially if he's tying these big, like, Christmas tinsel flies. You know, the Christmas trees and that kind of stuff, they're just basically big, long tinsel flies. I would put some kind of a stinger hook in there on a fairly stiff mono so that it would stay back there and not flop around and so on. Mm-hmm. Because if those fish are short-striking on a big hook, which they could easily do on a fly that's that long, I think a stinger hook in there would help dramatically.
Okay, we're running out of time, but I did promise folks you would share with them a few of your presentation methods. You've got a whole slew of them in the book, which we can't go through all of them, but I found a few, like the broadside float, shotgunning, jig swinging, sink and swim, fishing the lip. Can you share with us, you know, what those are about or when they might be used, and as best you can?
Sure. Let's start with a just a standard down and across swing. A lot of people like to use this one for long flies because it's relatively simple to use. You just cast literally down and across stream and let the currents drag your fly back to your side. And a lot of times when the fly is accelerating around, you know, you just cast down and across and it sort of begins to accelerate across. A lot of times fish will nab it when it's doing that. But let me point out that a lot of times fish will follow the fly and not take it. So they might come all the way across the stream to your side, and the fly's hanging downstream from you. Don't just pick it up immediately. Give it a couple of strips and let it hang there for a second or two. A lot of times fish will take it when it's right there. Then what you can do is we can build that into what we call a jigging swing. So we're going to cast down and across with a fly that's got enough weight on it that it will sink right to the bottom. And I like to do this, if I can, with either a short sink tip or with a floating line, because you need to pull the fly up, so you can't have a full sinking line because it's going to hold the fly down. So you're going to cast down and across, and then you're going to keep the rod tip up fairly high and bounce the fly up and down as it swings across. So just twitching the rod tip up and letting the fly drop, twitching it up, letting it drop back, twitching it up, letting it drop back. That one can be really effective because now you've got a fly that's crossing the stream, and it's also like a minnow that's down there on the bottom, or a leech that's down getting into the rocks and then coming up and getting back down into the rocks. And I use that one a lot for salmon here in the lake states and big browns and steelhead, too. It works really well that way. Then there's a technique that I've developed I call the bait fish from L, because in this particular one you're casting down and across stream, but rather than just casting straight down and across, to cast down on a cross and use a curve cast in the, so that it throws the fly in against the bank with the line coming straight out and then coming up and across to you. Then you just hold the rod, and the pressure of the water against the line causes the fly to swim straight out from the bank rather than just swinging and having its butt end hanging downstream. It comes straight out so that it has a side profile. So if there are fish there, they see the fly in side profile rather than an end profile. And this has turned out to be a really effective technique for lots of things. And I use it not only fishing downstream, but also when I fish across and when I fish up. When I fish up, I just curve cast it upstream and then strip it or just let it float down dead drift. That's a really good technique. When I'm fishing across with it, I'll cast across and then I'll mend the L into the line and let the fly swim down, and then when it gets downstream, let the pressure of the current swim it across. Mm-hmm. There's also Joe Brooks's broadside float, and that's basically the bait fish from L is sort of a combination of the swinging technique and the broadside float. In the broadside float, he would simply cast across and then mend to keep the fly just dead drifting sideways in the currents. His idea was that a fish is much more apt to pick up a fly if it sees it in side profile than if it sees it in end profile. Mm-hmm. And if it's dead drifting, it's acting like a minnow that's distorted or hurt or something. And again, that triggers the predatory response of the fish. Those are all very good
techniques. Coming at you, you know, if you're the fish,
yeah,
and you're all
side
looking
profile coming at the fish rather than the end profile. Yeah.
Right.
And then, of course, there's the classic cast and strip it back as fast as you can, and cast it back and strip it not quite as fast as you can, and then cast and strip it back slower. So
yeah.
All of those work depending
up,
upon the
right?
Yeah, all those work depending upon the conditions. Then there's, of course, other things you can do. Certainly with flies that are fished on the film, you know, just pull it underneath and let it come back to the surface is a great technique.
Mm-hmm.
And you can use a full sinking line, or you can use a sink tip line and a longer leader and pitch it out and let the line go down, the fly is sitting on top, and then when you pull, the leader draws the fly under, and the line stays down, then the fly comes back to the top, and you can do that time after time after time. Now, sort of in the opposite of that, in the other direction, more and more, especially European anglers, which tend to experiment more with stillwater situations, they're using full sinking lines or sink tip lines and a fully floating fly, but a leader that's only about 6 feet long, and the sinking line then pulls the fly right down onto the bottom. And then what you do is, when you pull on the line itself, the fly goes right to the bottom, and then when you stop, it tries to float back to the surface again. So this is sort of like anti-jigging. It's like jigging in reverse, because the fly tries to float, and then when you pull, it goes to the bottom, rather than the fly being on the bottom and you lifting it.
Mm-hmm.
They're using these extensively in England, in the reservoirs there, has turned out to be a very effective technique, because you can fish a fly above the weeds and not get it caught up in the weeds, but make it look like it's swimming down toward the weeds.
Mm-hmm.
So you can fish it right above the bottom weeds and do very, very well. The guys in the Scandinavian countries are using it for a sea trout. Very effective technique for sea trout. Sea trout are just basic, or not... I should say sea run trout. These are browns that go out of the rivers and hang out in the estuaries or in the shallow nearshore waters, and then return, of course, to go up in the rivers to spawn. But you can catch them in the nearshore waters all along the ocean, along the shoreline, along the ocean, and you can catch them in the estuary areas.
Yeah.
They call them sea trout, but they're really just browns that have run out into the ocean and out there before they come back in to spawn.
Well, Gary, you've given the folks a lot of great tips there, and, of course, there's a lot more to it. So my recommendation is they get your book. Get the whole story.
That's mine, too.
Yeah. So,
sure.
But we've run out of time, so I need to wrap things up here. And so stick with me, Gary, because we're going to give your book
sure.
away here in a few minutes and do a little contest here. And we're also giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. So stick around. You might get one of those through our drawing, or Gary Borger's latest book, Long Flies. And We'll be right back to do just that. Family Ties, that's T-Y-E-S, Family Ties is an organization which uses a shared interest in fly fishing and fly tying to enhance youth development and family relationships. They utilize resources in schools, communities, and businesses, and they invite your participation. Go to their website at www.familyties.com. That's family, T-Y-E-S.com. Family Ties, where every fish is a trophy and every kid is a hero. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section of tonight's show that says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave us your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Now it's time to give away our prizes, and the winners of these drawings are from our database and are randomly drawn from the registration database. If you haven't registered yet, then it's too late now, but do this for our next show, our upcoming shows, because we're always giving away some great memberships and subscriptions and other prizes. So please do that, and maybe you'll be a winner next time. If you do win tonight, we'll contact you by email and get your information and so that you can get your prize. First thing we're going to draw tonight for is a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, and our winner for that is Bob Silver in New Mexico. Bob Silver in New Mexico. So congratulations, Bob. You already have a membership. We'll get it extended. If you don't, you're really going to enjoy this and being part of the Federation, as many of us are. If you're not aware of the Federation and want to learn more about it, go to fedflyfishers.org. That's fedflyfishers.org. Now we'll give away a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. And if you don't know about Fly Fusion, they are out of Calgary, Canada, a great magazine to have in your stack and a great one to learn from. And we have a winner there of Al Laurent in Oklahoma. So congratulations, Al. And those of you that didn't win, go to flyfusionmag.com. That's flyfusionmag.com, and you can check out the magazine there. Okay, so those two are done. Congratulations to both Al and Bob on those. And now we'll give away Gary's latest book, Long Flies, third book in a 20-book series. So you'll have lots of, you'll just want to get this whole collection, I think, but you got a chance to win one of them tonight. And this is going to be a two-part question. The first part of the question has to do with what are the two primary hook sizes that Gary likes to use for long flies, two sizes, and what type of fly could be applied to all the long flies. In other words, there's a certain aspect or technique or principle that could be applied to all the long flies we talked about tonight that Gary said that would make them more effective and maybe more realistic or action-oriented to the fish. So let's see here. I hope I gave enough of a hint as to what I'm looking for there. So, Gary, I'm waiting here to see first one was 3X and 4X. That part you got right, but stripping and jigging isn't what I'm looking for. Gary, do you know what I'm looking for?
Absolutely.
Okay. This one was, we got part of it right. This was 4 and 6 articulated, but that's not quite what we were looking for. Here we go. I think this is it, Gary. This answer is 3XL, 4XL, and articulated. Do we have a winner?
That isn't what I was thinking of, but that is certainly one of them.
Okay, well, that's what I was thinking of.
All right. That's
Are the hook sizes right?
Yes.
Okay, and I was thinking of articulated as something that could be applied to all of them, so...
Absolutely.
So what was the other thing you were thinking of? Just to give
acoustic footprint.
Acoustic footprint. That would have been a good one, too. Yeah. I don't know if we said that clearly enough, but But anyway, we've got a winner. Oh, I
certainly, articulations definitely help in any fly. That's
yeah,
certainly true.
Yeah. So that our winner there is Brian Furterer in Dayton, Ohio. So, Brian, you just won Gary's
excellent
book, Long Flies. So
hey, that's good. Hey, I know Brian.
You do?
Good work, Brian. Sure. I was just in Dayton.
Oh, yeah. Oh, good, good.
Certainly.
So there
had
we go. Did you really?
Yeah, excellent.
But Dayton
work,
already
Brian
have your book, does he? Well, if he does, he can give it as
sure
a gift to someone else. So it's always something you can do with something you have to live, right? So share it around. So Brian, I've got your email here. I will connect with you, and we'll get your information out to Gary, and he'll get that book sent off to you. So appreciate you playing, and everyone else, too, for participating. That's great. Well, Gary, thanks again for being on the show with us. It's always a pleasure to talk with you and your son Jason, and I know we haven't given Jason the credit on your books, but he's playing a large part of this. It's not just you.
Oh, absolutely.
Books, right? Yeah.
He does
so
all the layout design, all the artwork, all the photography.
Yeah. So
when they get long flies, they can look in the back. There's a whole chapter of, there's 81 flies in full color as sample flies to show design imitation or design concepts and that sort of thing. They'll be really delighted how wonderfully these flies turned out and how beautiful the color reproduction is.
Well, we want to give Jason credit and thanks, too.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, because he plays such a large part. Well, thanks again, Gary, and
hopefully. And thank you for having me on tonight, Roger. I appreciate it very much.
Yeah, we'll talk with you when that next book comes out.
All right.
All right, sounds good.
All right.
Next broadcast will be on May 2nd, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. That show we're going to interview Mike Radenovich, and our topic for the show will be tying the classic salmon fly. What a good extension from tonight's talk. Mike has been tying the classic salmon fly since 1990. These flies are the most beautiful of all fishing flies. They're truly captivating, and whether fished on big water or proudly framed and displayed. So you want to listen in to Mike share over 20 years of experience in both tying and photographing these exquisite flies. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Print Range Anglers, Power Fibers Online Magazine, and Women's Fly Fishing Alaska for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company will benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. We'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening, Ask.